Before we jump into this interview, I wanted to make mention of the fact that the interview that we're presenting is designed to provide accurate and helpful information regarding whatever the subject matter is that's being covered. But we're making this available with the understanding that we're not endeavoring to be offering specific legal, accounting, medical, financial, psychological, or other professional services. Laws and regulations are continually changing, and they can vary according to location and time. So we're just not wanting to make any kind of representation that the information here that we're offering is applicable for all locations and times. And if you need legal advice, medical advice, psychological advice, accounting advice, or whatever, obviously we want you to seek out the services of competent professionals in the area of need. But we hope this is very helpful to you, and we wish you the very best as you listen. God bless you.
This is Tony Cook, and I want to welcome you to this interview session with Dr. Dale Doty. And we're going to be talking about building an affair-proof marriage. No couple gets married with the intention that one of them is going to have an affair.
Sure.
And yet, what's the prevalence of adultery affairs in
actually,
our country?
Actually, I'd have to back up and say that may not entirely be true. There are some people who truly have the view, they've been raised with the view that having affairs is normal and expected. Hmm. And so some people have been unfaithful to every partner they've ever had. And, you know, and in some cultures, you know, it's just kind of the expected thing that men will in fact have affairs, or maybe even women will have their secret, you know, partners or mm-hmm. whatever. So unfortunately, there are some people who do go into relationships like that, much to the shock of their partner when their partner later discovers it. Mm-hmm. But I would say for the most part, what you say is true. Most people don't plan on purpose to have an affair on their spouse. What I believe is that the majority of the cases I see in my counseling practice are those people who may have started off kind of innocently in a relationship with someone where the boundaries were not in the proper place, where there was some kind of, you know, increasing level of sharing on an intimate level, personal feelings or feelings of attraction or whatever. Or, you know, maybe the relationship wasn't so innocent. It was flirtatious from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And people, you know, flirted with each other, you know, kind of testing the waters to see, you know, how open the other person might be, you know, to doing something, you know, that might be inappropriate. And then there are other people who really are angry at their partner, and so they may have an affair, kind of retaliatory affair, you know, or the kind of affair where a person justifies, since I do not get my needs met with my partner, since my partner doesn't care about me or whatever, therefore I'm somehow justified to look someplace mm-hmm. else for relationships and sex. Affairs, I think one of the things that's also a misnomer is that affairs are always about sex. And many times that's not necessarily true. Sometimes people are really looking for a friend, someone who's, you know, more affirming to be with, that's more positive to us than our spouse might be, that we long for someone to appreciate us or, you know, talk kindly to us or whatever. And so some people have, you know, close intimate relationships with someone just because they feel the warmth and the care of that person, and ultimately then sexual feelings result from mm-hmm. it. And the relationship may become sexual, but some may never become sexually intimate. The studies that Kinsey did, you know, many, many years ago back in the 50s indicated that about 50% of men and, you know, somewhere between 20 and 30% of women will have an affair, you know, sometime during the course of their marriage. More recent studies suggest that number of 50% for men is probably pretty accurate, pretty close. You know, I've seen numbers higher, sometimes a little lower, but most of the studies kind of hover right in that range. But real clearly, the number of women having affairs has become higher, partly because of women's liberation, whatever that means, and, you know, women becoming more open about their sexual needs and,
more
you know,
women
the culture,
in the workplace.
More women in the workplace. place. You know, the culture where we have, you know, Sex in the City type, you know, popular shows that depict, you know, people being sexually, you know, liberated or even promiscuous. You know, as though that's some kind of a right that we have sex with whoever we want, whenever we want. Those kinds of attitudes have increased the numbers. And in fact, among young women today, it is reported that the numbers of young women having affairs outside their marriage is actually higher than some males in some circles. And so it may be that women are now caught up and may even exceed the numbers of men, you know, in the future.
Mm-hmm. Is it true? I've heard this anecdotally. I don't know if it's statistically true, that it used to be that a man would have an affair and run off and leave his wife and children, and that today there's a higher prevalence of women leaving and the husband being left with the children.
You know, I don't know that I have, you know, honest statistics about the numbers of people who leave their marriage for another. What I do know is that in the divorce statistics, you know, that having an affair is one of the major contributing factors to divorce. So it's up there very high with spouse abuse and other kinds of things, a partner who's being unfaithful to each other. But clearly in my practice, I see examples of both men and women who leave their families, you know, for this other person, that this other person becomes more important than their children, than their jobs, their careers, their church positions, their leadership, their witness for the Lord, you know, and so people are willing to pay very high prices once they end up in those kinds of relationships that they can't seem to turn away from.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that the majority of your practice, and correct me if I'm wrong, the majority of your practice is probably on the curative side, not on the preventative side.
That's correct.
What if, and so you deal with situations where people are coming into your office and affairs occurred in the marriage and, you know, trying to put the pieces back together again. You probably don't have nearly as many situations, although I do know you do have a strong premarital program. But what counsel would you give to a young couple that, if they even ever think to ask this, you know, Dr. Doty, we want to really live out our vows that we will honor and cherish one another, keeping ourselves from all others till death do us part. What can we do to build an affair-proof marriage?
That's a great question, and in fact, there was a great book years ago on affair-proofing your marriage. The book died, you know, sadly, because who's going to go into the bookstore and buy a marriage on affair-proofing your marriage? You know, the problem is that it kind of suggests that you're already struggling with that problem or whatever. The thing that I see most commonly are people who simply say, well, I'm just not going to do it, and that's all the thought they've given to it. They have no plan for how they're going to do it. And, you know, unfortunately, it's only after the fact, that after they've made the mistake, they've crossed a boundary, their partner is hurt by their behavior, whatever, that they really then begin to realize that it takes more thought to actually be successful at this than simply saying, I won't do it. That, again, it's not a one-step process. You know, in one step, we go from being pure to, you know, having sex with another person. It doesn't happen like that. Sometimes it starts in our thought life, where there's a fantasy life about either a promiscuous relationship, a one-night stand kind of an idea, or it starts in our thought life with relationships with people that we have that are otherwise innocent relationships. Mm-hmm. We may have a good working relationship with a coworker or, you know, a boss or, you know, someone at work that we see on a regular basis and spend time with. You know, a recent story, you know, that I heard was, you know, two people who were working together on a mission project, and I've heard this story many times before, working together on a mission project, and, you know, where the two persons on this team, a man and a woman, both married to other people. You know, we're spending time working and legitimately doing the work of the church. But in addition to that time, they started spending more time talking to each other and visiting about their lives and sharing their feelings. And before you know it, the relationship is deeper. They're then seeing each other without their partner's knowledge. That's when the affair begins. And ultimately, it became sexual.
So camaraderie begins, and then it comes into a realm of secrecy, and then that just becomes a breeding ground for everything else.
That's right. So the advice that I would give to people is that, you know, first and foremost, we keep no secrets from our partner, that we will not behave in any way, that we will not be willing to reveal 100% of the whole story to our partner. The vow we take if we go to court is to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's a good, you know, definition of the truth, you know, as we should apply it in marriage. That if we tell a half-truth to our partner, we happen to leave out, you know, as we describe a conversation with a, you know, with a, another person of the opposite sex, if we leave out some details of the conversation that we realize our partner probably wouldn't be too happy to know about. If we told some sexual joke or there was some reference to, you know, sexual frustration or whatever, you know, in a conversation between, you know, two people, that information should be, you know, shared with a spouse. And if a spouse has problems with that, and they should have problems with that, you know, that they can speak up, that they can have some say about how this relationship is going. That we also have to be aware that an affair and a relationship that is damaging to a marriage does not have to include sex. Mm-hmm. That some of the most damaging relationships I've ever seen to marriages are long-standing friendship relationships that become increasingly intimate, where those two people keep secrets with each other from their spouses. And when those things are discovered, the damage to trust and the damage to, you know, the ability to proceed with, you know, any kind of a marriage relationship or intimacy or whatever with a partner, the feelings of betrayal are every bit as great as if sex had been involved. Mm-hmm. So it's still hurtful and damaging and I think sinful to be dishonest with our spouse, to betray them by keeping secrets about the nature of our relationship with others.
Mm-hmm. What are there different dynamics in terms of, for example, when a man has an affair, what are the dynamics that make him vulnerable? What are the dynamics, the issues that can trigger that process? And then with a woman, do men and women typically get into affairs for the same reasons?
Well, I mean, again, certainly both men and women have affairs for emotional affirmation, and men and women have affairs for sex. So I'm not sure that the dynamics are very different personally. Mm-hmm. I think we all have some of the same needs. We have the need for a close relationship with somebody who is affirming to us, mm-hmm. where we have a positive view of one another. If our marriage has deteriorated to the point where we no longer speak kind words to each other, we no longer have empathy for each other, that we are no longer able to say positive things to the other even when we struggle, if we've gotten into the saying critical and negative things to each other all the time, that we never let up on each other, that we're always kind of angry with each other, I mean, we're in serious, serious danger, not only of the affair, but of the destruction of the marriage, the loss of the marriage. People often say, I'm committed to my partner, you know, and I will stay with them no matter what. Well, I'm not sure that that's what most people really believe and mean. You know, that most people will have a limit as to what they are willing to accept. Sometimes they don't realize what their limit is. But if we do not treat one another right, if we do not have a kind, loving, you know, effective communication, you know, system that keeps our anger, frustration level down with each other, over time, that chips away at the foundation of commitment. If after years you realize I've not had a kind word from my partner or whatever, why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. You know, why should I put up with this? If sex in the relationship has deteriorated, where there's no longer any kind of regular frequency of sexual intimacy for a couple, that's not normal. Paul warns, you know, because there's temptation, don't defraud each other. Don't withhold meeting sexual needs of one another. So I think what we've got to do is fulfill our responsibilities to keep our marriages healthy. And if we don't, that's the most powerful, vulnerable factor that I think – the factors that can contribute to people being, you know, susceptible. Mm-hmm. And good people, you know, who had every intention of being faithful to their partner, who are not getting their needs met with their spouse, who are with members of the opposite sex, are in a vulnerable position. Mm-hmm. I also think another factor that contributes to affairs is naivete. My partner would never – you know, have an affair. My partner would never, you know, be tempted. My partner would never, I don't know who they're talking about, but even Superman had his vulnerability. You know, the fact is we all have some vulnerability. We all have some, you know, inner unmet need, in, you know, some area where we, you know, could be attracted to someone else, you know, if there are no safeguards, if there's no boundary, if there's no accountability, you know, whatever. Anyone who thinks that their partner can spend, you know, large amounts of unsupervised time one-on-one with a member of the opposite sex and not ultimately have feelings or start to cross boundaries with our words, with our thought life, and then with our physical behavior, I think is naive. We've got to be careful. That's not true. We all have those vulnerabilities. And that's not a bad thing that we hold one another accountable. I think that's part of being helpmates to each other. We recognize the vulnerability of our partner, and we're not jealously seeking to follow them around and accuse them falsely. But when they're in a vulnerable situation, that we ask questions, we express concern, we work with our partner to try to build some boundaries, some safeguards, you know, so that those relationships don't go south mm-hmm. and cause all kinds of harm.
Scripture that comes to mind is 1 Corinthians 10:12. Wherefore, let him who thinks he stand take heed lest he fall. Mm-hmm. If I ever believe that I'm invincible, then I'm set up. If a person ever believes that their spouse is immune to temptation or something like that, that then becomes grounds for a problem.
Well, I think of the story of Joseph where, you know, Joseph was, you know, being seduced, you know, by the wife of the leader that he was serving. And, you know, he literally left his coat in her arms and ran for his life. I mean, that's the kind of thing, you know, that Paul advises Timothy. Flee youthful lust. Run for your life from it. You know, because, again, sometimes lust feels good, you know, at the moment that it's, you know, that it's kind of, you know, the flirtation kind of is, you know, has a nice feeling associated with it, you know, but it's kind of like the warnings that we see in Proverbs and other places, you know, the temptation ultimately leads to disaster. You know, we're warned to run away from, you know, temptation and to realize just how harmful it ultimately can become. You know, we cross one boundary, it gets easier to cross the next boundary. And it's a gradual process. It may take hours, it may take, you know, weeks or months, you know, but we must be careful. Now, some people obviously progress at a much more rapid level once they've already been lusting in their minds already. So the person who's been entertaining the fantasy of having an affair, when given the opportunity, the affair may progress very rapidly because they are already thinking there's nothing wrong with it, that it's okay, I'm justified, you know, I'm finally entitled somehow, mm-hmm. you know, to do this because my partner doesn't meet my needs. And that's a wrong rationalization. When we tell ourselves that, you know, there's not going to be a consequence or that we're somehow justified in doing what is wrong, you know, we play into the hand of the enemy. Mm-hmm. You know, those are thoughts that will ultimately lead us to destruction.
Mm-hmm. Are there key events in people's lives? Are there trigger issues? You hear about the 7-year itch. You hear about midlife crisis. I've heard that if an individual came out of a family, for example, a young man whose father was prone to play around, that young man will then be more likely to do that. I've heard that following the death of a parent, that an individual can be more susceptible to affairs. Are these valid, legitimate?
Well, I think your key word is vulnerability. I mean, I think we become vulnerable, you know, at many points in our life to any kind of relief of our discomfort. So, you know, if we're grieving, you know, some people drink as a way of alleviating the pain of their grief. You know, they may take prescription medication as a way to do that. Other people may turn to others, even sex, as a way of killing the pain of the, you know, the discomfort. So there's the comfort affair, you know, the person who seeks comfort, you know, during a time of grieving or hurting or whatever. There's the revenge affair that happens when a partner has hurt us in some way. You know, some partners will have an affair. Their other spouse will go out and have an affair as a way of showing them what it feels like. Or they feel entitled finally to do what they've thought about doing all along, but since their partner gave in, now they have a right to give in. So there are ways we twist these things around in our minds to make them somehow okay to ourselves, and ultimately then we do what we think. So our thought life is a key factor. I think that there are people who clearly are philanderers. They have always had affairs. They have never been faithful to a partner. They're constantly on the hunt, you know, for a new partner. You know, the life is all about the seduction. I had a man in my office, you know, that had literally had 100 different, you know, sexually illicit relationships or whatever. I mean, he had put the gun in his mouth and pulled back the hammer numerous times, you know, in the pain of the guilt of his life, you know, on the verge of suicide. You know, in our culture, we tend to think of someone who's had so many sex partners as someone who's a Don Juan, or it almost has a positive connotation. But the reality is that people who do this and are out of control with it sometimes would rather die than continue behaving in the way they're behaving. So it becomes such a way of life of destroying relationships and people and trust and, you know, whatever, that people are powerless and may actually be sexually addicted. They may be a sex addict. You know, and so, you know, we may have a much, much deeper problem than simply an affair. There's a chronic problem with out-of-control sexual behavior.
Mm-hmm. What do you have situations, Dr. Doty, where people come into the office and no affair has been proven in the marriage, but the individual is suspicious? Maybe their spouse is not coming in for counseling at this time. When a person just comes in and says, Dr. Doty, I believe my spouse is being unfaithful. I have no proof, but I'm suspicious. Are there guidelines you give them?
Sure. I think it's important, particularly for those of us that are counselors, to really listen and hear, you know, what it is that concerns that person. You know, for those of us that have some objectivity, many times when we hear the person speak, it kind of begins to – we begin to lean in one direction or another about the story that's being told. There are some people who have absolutely no evidence, no reason to believe, but when they tell you their story, they tell you a story of a father who was constantly, you know, unfaithful, or a mother who was constantly unfaithful. So they're just assuming their partner must be like that person they grew up with, but where there's no indication that there are signs. But other people come in with signs, legitimate signs. They see telephone numbers that are appearing on cell phone bills or whatever that are unaccounted for, and their partner gives flimsy excuses. Their partner is chronically late, or, you know, and sometimes by considerable amounts of time. There's unaccounted for time. There's money that may be missing. The person goes out of town often. There's some hint that, you know, that they have a close relationship with someone, but then they, you know, they suspect they're seeing them outside of the workplace or wherever it is they know them. But, you know, or sometimes the secrets kind of leak out, you know, that they were in the same place, you know, with this person or whatever. But then the excuses are, you know, don't seem to be real plausible or whatever. I think for a person who is, you know, wondering and worrying and whatever, they've got to satisfy themselves whether it is either is true or isn't true. Is there enough evidence to convict them or not? You know, and what's the overall condition of the marriage anyway? You know, is there a tendency to tell little lies in other areas? Is there a problem really with integrity? So this is just one more area of worry about integrity. They don't tell the truth about their finances or the way they spend their money. They don't tell the truth about where they were or what they were doing. They use lies to cover up, you know, other kinds of problems. I mean, so I think we have to listen to the person as they describe the partner, their relationship, you know, the things they think are signs. Now, many of those persons may not ever have proof that there's an affair, yet they have quite a bit of you know, evidence that's convincing that their marriage is troubled. And so sometimes we, you know, encourage those persons to talk to their partner about entering marital therapy to work on healing the harmed marriage, mm-hmm. even though we don't know for sure whether or not an affair has occurred. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes in marital therapy, those things will surface, sometimes not. You know, what I believe is that if we are working toward an increasingly healthy marriage where we communicate effectively, we are kind to one another, we speak the truth to each other, we do it in a loving manner, that we spend time seeking, you know, to build passion and adventure together, that we enjoy each other's company, we're friends, we look forward to activity together, we make plans to spend time with each other. I mean, in that context, affairs are much less likely to be occurring or continue. It's when there's lots of distance and people have come to live with distance and frustration and animosity that the atmosphere is ripe for, you know, the birth of affairs. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, I'm not absolutely convinced that every affair has to be uncovered and punished and whatever. Some spouses will never, ever tell the truth about whether they did or didn't. Mm-hmm. You know, what really matters is what kind of relationship are they going to have for the future? Mm-hmm. Are they going to be truthful to each other in the future? Are they going to be accountable to each other in the future? Some people will go to their deathbed with a secret, mm-hmm. You know, and you can't get it out of them. But does that mean we have to give up on the marriage? Not necessarily. But if this person is able to get their other concerns addressed, then they can actually affair-proof their marriage for the future without necessarily having full disclosure about what's occurred in the past. Mm-hmm. Now, other people become so consumed by and obsessed with what might have happened in the past that they'll never be satisfied. And frankly, they will never turn loose of it until maybe they lose their marriage or the marriage is destroyed, you know, trying to seek the fact about the past, mm-hmm. looking for some kind of justice or whatever. Sometimes we just have to forgive each other of even the things we don't necessarily know about in order to go forward.
Mm-hmm. What are the things – and I realize this – because people tend not to seek help. And I remember a statement you made many years ago. You said, most people don't change until the pain is sufficient. Mm-hmm. Am I quoting you accurately on
close.
That?
Yes.
And when I heard you say that, I began to think of that in many situations I'd seen in the past. I began to use that statement to evaluate situations I saw on an ongoing basis. And I saw that, generally speaking, that's an enormously true statement, that people don't change until the pain is sufficient. We also know, I believe it was Benjamin Franklin that said, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Mm-hmm.
Problem is, we aren't usually as interested in the prevention. Sure. But if a couple were to say to you, we want to let's just take both the lady and the man separately. They each individually say to you, what can I do to create a home environment where my spouse will – we know there's temptation in the world, but will be minimally tempted. We won't aggravate or accentuate the temptations. What can I do to create the kind of home atmosphere that will cause my husband, cause my wife to not be as likely to stray?
I think, you know, first and foremost, that we will tell the whole truth, nothing but the truth, you know, so help us God to one another.
The honesty.
The honesty, that we will not tell even small lies to each other, realizing that we damage trust, we put distance between us, that we harm our relationship by even the smallest omission. So it's not so much just, you know, only telling the truth, but we must tell the whole truth so we don't omit some facts that we think our partner might object to. Mm-hmm. We don't cut corners when it comes to integrity with each other. In addition to that, that we have certain vows that we've taken to each other, not only not to be unfaithful with each other, but not to put ourselves in a position where temptation can increase above our ability to control ourselves. So we will not spend time alone with members of the opposite sex, that we will avoid that at all costs. You know, that if we are in those situations, that we have rules about how we speak to members of the opposite sex, that we don't allow flirtation, you know, toying with sexual subject matter, mm-hmm. you know, we will not disclose feelings of attraction or, you know, feelings of love for another person, even if we feel them, mm-hmm. because what that does is it only accelerates the response on the other person's part and what have you.
So you've got, if I can interject this here, you've got an individual in a work environment. He starts to feel attracted to an individual that he works with. And you're saying that individual should not say to the other person, hey, I just want you to know I feel attracted to you.
Absolutely. You know, and in fact, you know, there was a book years ago written for counselors that talked about the importance of the counselor being honest with their client. You know, unfortunately, there have been numerous counselors who have ended up having sexual relations with patients as a result of that advice. Mm-hmm. It's bad advice that we need to keep our feelings of attraction, our feelings of love, if you will, toward another person, to ourselves, if we're married, that we do not, because expressing those things becomes a way of testing the water to see if it's reciprocated by the other person. It then gives the other person, you know, permission to disclose their feelings back to you. Mm-hmm. If two people in a marriage tell each other of their attraction to each other or their, you know, their desires for each other, that's called foreplay. Mm-hmm. You know, and it accomplishes the same thing in a work relationship or a friendship relationship where, you know, it is inappropriate for it to ever become anything more than a business relationship. I think that, you know, we need to watch in our workplace that we keep our behavior business-like, mm-hmm. that even though we may like the people we work with, we may be friendly with the people we work with, that we don't get too terribly personal, that we don't share secrets with someone else, that we don't have the permission of our partner to share, that the information I have to share with other people about my life and my marriage belongs not only to me but also to my wife. Mm-hmm. She has a right to have a say in who that information is shared with. So information about her or information about me, you know, my most intimate thoughts and feelings and struggles and whatever, it's between my wife and I who that information is ultimately shared with. That for the most part, we do that if we're going to share with members of the opposite sex, we do it couple to couple or in group, you know, where there's not the vulnerability of achieving a false sense of intimacy with a person, you know, that is achieved in a one-on-one situation, that we don't make phone calls to people without our partner knowing the full nature of the phone calls that we make, who mm-hmm. initiated those phone calls, that if others are, you know, don't have the same kind of boundaries, that we let the person know that we have a commitment to our partner not to talk to other people over the phone in a friendly manner, you know, without my partner knowing the full nature of that or whatever. Sometimes couples go so far as to have clear rules about not having lunch with members of the opposite sex one-on-one, you know, and if there's going to be a person that's going to be present, that it's a person who would hold us accountable, that would not, you know, permit or encourage, you know, any kind of, you know, in affair or whatever. I mean, affairs sometimes occur right under the noses of people in the workplace, and they approve of each other's behavior. They actually encourage each other. So it's not enough to have a witness. We have to have a witness or a person that's an accountability person that actually upholds a high standard. And so, again, you know, people sometimes have, you know, affairs among one another in groups that work and, you know, while traveling and other kinds of things where there's kind of a party atmosphere that we don't participate in that kind of an atmosphere, even if it exists, you know. And sometimes we have to pay a high price to leave our place of work because there's such an environment of promiscuity. You know, I've known of many people who work in different industries or different, you know, businesses or whatever, where the atmosphere is far too loose. It's far too dangerous. There's far too much, you know, kind of encouragement of hanky-panky, you know, where it's a culture. It's acceptable. And to place ourselves in such an atmosphere is inviting trouble. You know, again, I don't think any of us is invincible to the possibility of an affair. We are influenced by the people that we hang out with. Mm-hmm. We're influenced by their character and by their integrity.
Mm-hmm. What role do you see anger and resentment playing in the developing of affairs?
I think it's a big factor. I think that feeling angry and resentful toward a partner, being either unable to express it or in a constructive way, or a partner who will – the spouse that will not hear them, listen to them, do problem solving with them, may only get angry, you know, back at them, where it escalates into ugliness, and ultimately the breakdown of communication, where finally we've argued enough, we just won't talk anymore. That pattern is very prevalent in affairs. Mm-hmm. So if we can't get our emotional needs met, we don't, we're no longer hopeful about being able to talk to our partner or be understood by our partner. We don't have much hope any longer for finding mutually agreeable solutions to the problems that we experience together. We have many unresolved problems with each other, and there's really no hope of being able to resolve them because we don't communicate effectively enough. Mm-hmm. That is an extremely dangerous condition to be in. And many people live with that condition for, you know, weeks, months, years, and sometimes years and years, 20 years, 30 years, you know, until the day when finally something bad happens. You know, one person is finally in a vulnerable enough situation or finally makes up their mind, I don't have to put up with this anymore. I'm justified somehow in getting my needs met someplace else. Mm-hmm. You know, or someone comes along that finally pays attention. And given the choice of going home to an angry spouse or, you know, spending time with this person who's kind to me, they choose the kind person over going home. So I think that many marriages are drifting dangerously and really declining gradually over time in satisfaction, in communication, in understanding, increasing instead in anger and resentment that are headed for trouble. And maybe the trouble will be an affair. Maybe the trouble will simply be that the person goes and sees a lawyer and says, enough of this. I'm out of here. Mm-hmm. But those marriages are in trouble. And people who are in those marriages need to take care of themselves and solve the problems of their marriage and get the help they need before it's irreversible.
Mm-hmm. Used an interesting word there. You talked about people who justify the relationship. In other words, because of the frustrations, because of the anger, the resentment, an individual often say, well, this other person is not meeting all of my needs, and therefore I'm justified in pursuing this other relationship, and it's really not my fault. It's really my spouse's fault.
That's right.
And then you tie all that into the whole issue of the grass is always greener on the other side. Just out of curiosity, what
let me say this about another rationale that I hear fairly common that's you know almost as frequent as that one. The other one is that maybe they don't rate their marriage so terrible. You know, they actually may love their partner, you know, not be in any way considering a divorce, but the kind of thought that you can play around and keep it secret and nobody's going to get hurt by it. And so I love my partner and I'm going to go home to my partner and I would never want a divorce from my partner, but we're on this business trip and here's this opportunity. And so, you know, what another person doesn't know won't hurt them is kind of the theme of that kind of self-talk or that kind of rationalization. So I can do this and no one will ever know and no one will ever be hurt. You know, the problem is often, way too often, those affairs ultimately end up being uncovered, or we feel so much guilt, we ultimately end up confessing, you know, or it becomes a lifestyle and a habit, and then the habit is discovered because of our inability to cover all of the lies that we've told. So sometimes it starts off with the, you know, I'm just out playing and it's okay because if my partner never knows.
Mm-hmm. I came across a list in a leadership journal. I'm going to see if I can find a year on it here. Winter of 1988, so I've had this for a long time. But an individual, a minister actually, developed a list of points that whenever he was tempted, he would remember and remind himself of these points. It was a list of reasons not to have an affair. Mm-hmm. And I might just go over some of these things and feel free to interject thoughts as we do this. Number one, he said, the reason I won't have an affair is I want to avoid grieving the Lord who redeemed me. Mm-hmm. Number two, dragging his sacred name into the mud. Number three, one day having to look Jesus, the righteous judge, in the face and give an account for my actions. Number four, following in the footsteps of those whose immorality forfeited or crippled their ministries. And of course, for a non-minister, this could be their witness, their Christian witness. Inflicting untold hurt on my best friend, my wife. Losing my wife's respect and trust. Hurting my beloved children. Destroying my example and credibility with my children and nullifying both present and future efforts to teach them to obey God. In other words, why listen to a man who betrayed mom and us? If my blindness should continue, or my wife be unable to forgive, perhaps losing my wife and my children forever, causing shame to my family. For example, why isn't Daddy a pastor anymore? Losing self-respect, creating a form of guilt awfully hard to shake. Even though God would forgive me, would I be able to forgive myself? Forming memories and flashbacks that could plague future intimacy with my wife. Wasting years of ministry training and experience for a long time, perhaps permanently. Forfeiting the effect of years of witnessing to other family members and reinforcing their distrust for ministers, perhaps contributing to the hardness of their hearts. Undermining the faithful example and hard work of other Christians in our community, bringing great pleasure to Satan, the enemy of God and of all that is good, heaping judgment and endless difficulty on the person with whom I committed adultery. And here's one that a lot of times people don't think about, possibly bearing the physical consequences of such diseases as gonorrhea, syphilis, chlamydia, herpes, and AIDS, perhaps infecting my wife or, in the case of AIDS, even causing her death, possibly causing pregnancy with the personal and financial implications, including a lifelong reminder of my sin, bringing hurt to my fellow ministers, bringing hurt to my friends, especially those I've led to Christ and discipled. And finally, this has been a long list, invoking shame and lifelong embarrassment upon myself. That's a pretty sobering list.
And it's by no means, you know, it's completely inclusive. There are many others. You know, the cynicism of the non-Christian just becomes increased as a result of seeing a Christian ultimately fall in sin. And literally, families suffer for generations. There are children who are grieved and pained by it, or worse yet, learn a sinful pattern of life and relating from their parent that was an example to them, you know, carrying that into their own relationships and creating misery for others. There are many, many other possible consequences and reasons not to do it. Those are just some of the good reasons. The problem, Tony, that I see with this is that the passion of an illicit relationship is so powerful as to numb our conscience about all of those things, that once a person enters into a passionate relationship, it's like a drug. And under the – in fact, we sometimes even, you know, kind of among ourselves in therapy, you know, among therapists kind of joke about the affair psychosis. Now, it's not true that the person is actually psychotic, you know, seeing and hearing things that don't exist, you know, but the fact that people begin to think in totally irrational ways, that they have changed the way they think completely from the way they used to think. And so all of the things that used to motivate them are they're willing to throw out the window for a moment of passion. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the fact of the matter is that the bubble ultimately someday bursts, mm-hmm. that whatever level of passion they might feel toward this person, that they may have convinced themselves that they can't live without this person they're involved with or whatever, they'll throw away their family, their career, you know, whatever. The fact of the matter is that when that passion wears off, and it will, they're left with just a regular old relationship and lots of consequences that they can't reverse. Mm-hmm. And so people who leave their spouse to marry someone else, ultimately when the passion wears off, it's kind of like, I traded all that for this, mm-hmm. you know, and the regret may last the lifetime.
Mm-hmm. People don't think about the things on this kind of list when they're caught up in that euphoric state. And I know you jokingly said you all refer to it as an affair psychosis, but it very much is an affair deception. There's a deception that comes into their thinking that says, you know, I've got this bland relationship that is not fulfilling to me, but over here is this euphoric perfection. And help us on this. Is it correct that when people divorce their spouse, have an affair, divorce their spouse, and hook up with the other person, that there typically is a much higher divorce rate in second marriages than there is in first marriages?
There is. Not only is there a higher divorce rate, but the length of time it takes to achieve that state is much shorter. Mm-hmm. So it may have taken people 15 or 20 years for a marriage relationship to deteriorate to the point that they're willing to leave their marriage relationship, ultimately entering a new relationship without really having learned what went wrong with the first one or what we contributed to it. Mm-hmm. So the likelihood is that the divorce rate will be considerably higher than 50%, and depending on the factors, maybe considerably higher than that. You know, remarriage with children from previous relationships increases mm-hmm. the divorce rate. You know, among those couples, the complication of just working all that out mm-hmm. becomes sometimes overwhelming. And many of those divorces will take place in the first year or two of the mm-hmm. new relationship, you know, or three or four, you know, whereas maybe it took, you know, like we say, maybe 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, you know, to get to the point where someone was willing to leave their first marriage.
Mm-hmm. So there is an initial euphoria that's part of the temptation, the thrill of the forbidden.
Which is also a chemical process, by the way. Mm-hmm. You know, those lustful thoughts are telling ourselves how wonderful this person is, you know, being caught up in the adventure and the forbidden aspect of this relationship. You know, the affairs are very, very powerful at causing the brain to secrete a chemical called phenylethylamine. And that chemical is the chemical that's associated with this aroused state of passion. And it is not likely that it will be sustained. Most people, you know, for most people, the power of that kind of wears off over a few months, you know, or a year. And then they're back to this is just a regular relationship with all of the regular problems that all relationships have. And maybe if it started off with an affair, far more complicated.
Mm-hmm. Let's say that we've got someone listening to this and they are at a certain stage. They have begun to fraternize. They've begun to be very friendly towards someone at work. Maybe it's a pastor who's found himself attracted to an individual in the church. Maybe it's a lady in the church who's come. She's struggling in her marriage and she likes the attention that she's getting from the pastor because he listens to her better than her husband does at home. Mm-hmm. And because she is being very appreciative to him, you know, she's saying things like, "Oh, Pastor, you're so wonderful. You're such a godly anointed man." And he's getting more affirmation from her.
Even though she's going home to her husband telling him he never does anything around the house.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's just an artificial situation.
The grass is greener on everybody's other side.
That's right.
When a person finds themselves, they're in that point of they're feeling very attracted to this other person. They are thinking about this person in between times that they would, you know, just normally and routinely. Maybe they've even begun to create opportunities to justifiably be together, work
see each other
projects
more often,
or whatever.
Instance.
And they're thinking about some of these things. Wait a minute. I need to get the brakes put on this thing. I need to get this thing turned around. It's not gone over the edge yet. But if the people will really be honest with themselves, they are headed toward very dangerous territory.
That's right.
They're already on dangerous territory.
There's a part of them that hopes that something will happen between them. There's another part of them that knows they shouldn't let this go on. They're torn often back and forth inside their mind. You know, they need to run for their life like Joseph. Mm-hmm. They need to get out of that situation.
But it feels so good to them.
It does. And you know, it's the bait that the enemy uses to draw us into, you know, having made a mistake that the consequences may be irreparable. You know, some of the consequences may be irreversible. Though God can forgive us, some of the consequences are never erased. Pregnancies or disease or loss of respect, you know, due to discovery, all those kinds of things. I mean, some of that damage can never be undone. So people have to literally run for your life. For your life. It's not as though you might lose your life. You may actually lose your life. Maybe mm-hmm. maybe not to death, but lose all the things that are associated with your life, your family, your children, and all those other things that we mentioned earlier. So run for your life. In professional counseling, we try to teach therapists to refer. When you find that your attraction to this client has grown to the point, you know, where you're having thoughts about this client that are different from the thoughts you have about all your other clients, it's time, frankly, to refer that person to someone else. You know, now we don't abandon our clients. We have a responsibility not to just cut it off with no explanation, but neither do we need to give an explanation as to what my feelings are, because once again, that often confirms to the other person that in fact they feel about me the same way I feel about them. Therefore, I'm, you know, now free to express myself, you know, back mm-hmm. to them. And again, that's often foreplay.
It moves into intimacy.
It moves into a much more intimate level in the relationship. So, you know, what the counselor has to acknowledge is there's a conflict of interest. You know, the conflict of interest doesn't have to be disclosed, you know, but there's a conflict of interest. What is in my best interest and all of my other interests are now interfering with my ability to provide care to you. And, you know, pastors, frankly, need to do exactly the same thing. If it's worker and co-worker, you know, whatever, the same thing. We need to find an excuse to get out of that relationship. And we don't have an obligation to tell the reason for that. You know, we may need to keep that to ourselves because, again, telling the reason only elicits a response that can make the problem much more difficult or whatever. So the more disclosure we have made, the greater the level of intimacy and the more painful it will be to break away from it. So, you know, if we are true to our partner, we do not disclose those kinds of thoughts and feelings to other people. Most of our partners would not, under any circumstance, want us to do that, you know. And so, you know, we try to be faithful. I think oftentimes we have to confess to a partner that we are finding ourselves attracted to someone. Now, frankly, it takes a pretty healthy relationship for people to be able to share that, or at least a willingness to try to construct a healthy relationship. Sometimes that disclosure can lead to the building of a more healthy relationship, that we finally make ourselves vulnerable to our partner. In some cases where the relationship is unhealthy, maybe it will lead to the partner being incapable of being understanding. Maybe it will ultimately affirm that their spouse is really emotionally divorced from them. The possibility, if we do the right thing, is the right thing sometimes can lead to divorce.
So couples, I mean, from the very onset of marriage, really need to understand that marriage can be a fragile situation that really needs to be nurtured, guarded, protected, and brought up, kept healthy.
Sure. This conversation should not lead those that are in troubled relationships to believe that they are now justified to divorce their partner. I believe that it's our obligation as Christians to do everything we can, everything in our power, and even seek the counsel of others to figure out what to do, what else can I do to try to save my marriage, heal my marriage, and in fact, clearly to be patient with a partner, but ultimately for us to know that we cannot treat each other in any way we wish and be guaranteed that there will be a relationship left, after we've mistreated or neglected one another.
So verse in Proverbs, one that refers to men, one that refers to women, I want to say it's 11:29, that says, he who troubles his own house shall inherit the wind. Mm-hmm. And then a verse in, I want to say, Proverbs 14 that says, a wise woman builds her house, but a foolish woman plucks it down. Mm-hmm. And what I derive from that, the implication is that either individual in the marriage can conduct themselves in a way that brings destruction to the relationship.
Sure.
It's a sacred responsibility.
Neglect of marriage, I think, is the number one reason for affairs to occur in the first place, but it ultimately ends up with its own consequence. And so the neglect of a marriage where we're not kind to each other, we're not considerate to each other, we clam up, we harbor resentments and bitternesses or whatever, those relationships are losing ground and chipping away at commitment. Mm-hmm. And you can only chip away so long before the house of cards comes down. And, so we must be careful not to take our marriages for granted. It's a sinful way to think about your partner when you think to yourself, God hates divorce, therefore we'll live to each other together, but we won't talk to each other. Mm-hmm. We'll live in separate rooms in some cases, or literally on separate floors in the house, but we won't get a divorce. We'll at least do what God wants us to do. What a self-deception about what God really wants us to do. God hates some other things as much or more than he hates divorce.
Right.
And those that stir up strife constantly, that harm other people with mm-hmm. our behavior, whatever, God hates those things too, and maybe just as much as he hates divorce. So again, this is not a justification or rationalization for divorce. This is for us to be warned that we must take care of what we have mm-hmm. in our relationships with our partner, and God cares about the words that come out of our mouth to each other and the decisions to hold bitterness or resentment toward one another and those kinds of things, and there are consequences for those.
What I hear you saying is that God doesn't simply focus on the external status, but he cares about the internal substance. And if we take care of the internal substance, the external status is pretty well going to take care of itself.
I think that's really true. I think that, the legal status of the relationship isn't really the true barometer of the health of the relationship.
Final statement from you, Dr. Doty. Couple sitting in front of you saying, we really want to make this thing work. We want to make it for the long haul. We want to be married till death do us part. We want to do what we can to, number one, internally, individually have a commitment to faithfulness. But we also want to create the kind of atmosphere where it'll be easy for our partner to be faithful to us. We don't want to make it where they're having to resist unnecessary temptations. What can we do to build an affair-proof marriage? Can you boil it down to a paragraph?
I think of a couple that were giants in the field of the history of marriage counseling, for instance, David and Vera Mace. I met them when they were probably in their 70s, an incredible couple. And what they said was there are, three essential things that are necessary to a healthy marriage. One is commitment, but not just commitment to stay married, commitment to growing together. That we're truly committed through the course of our life together to continue to grow our marriage, to grow in our ability to communicate, to enrich our marriage. That enrichment of marriage is a lifelong commitment to each other. The second thing is the ability to communicate. that as a result of talking to each other, I can go away feeling understood. Not necessarily that my partner always agrees with me, but that each of us will have given each other the respect to hear each other and understand each other. So by the time we're finished communicating, I feel understood. My partner feels that I've listened and shown respect to their point of view, even if we adamantly disagree with each other. The third thing is the ability to resolve difference or difficulty, problem-solving skills, conflict resolution skills. So if we strongly disagree, we start to look for a third or a fourth or a fifth alternative, a way to solve the problem that's acceptable to both of us. And if those three things exist, there's a real strong chance that our relationship will survive and thrive even. And those are the things that I would hope that we would all come to be committed to, that we would view commitment as more than just staying married. It's committing to growing together, never settling for second best.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Well, Dale, thank you so much for this. It's been rich and good. And we just pray that every couple that listens to this, every individual will really apply themselves to that and be able to enjoy and experience what God has for their lives, for their marriages. Thank you.
Thanks.